Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Apocalypse, it's quite a word. It comes from the Greek word, which literally means to pull the lid off something or revelation. And that's where we begin this edition, with Tom Eblin in another of his series of Kentucky author interviews.
Dr. Chris Begley is an associate professor of anthropology at Transylvania University. He also is an archaeologist who has explored past civilizations, from the jungles of Honduras to shipwrecks beneath the Mediterranean Sea. Begley is the host of the Eastern Standard series Future Tense, where he talks with people about what we may expect from a post-pandemic world. And now he is the author of a new book, The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. In this book, Begley writes about how past civilizations have declined and fallen, and what we might expect in the future. Chris Begley is here to talk with us about his book today. Chris, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom.
So tell us a little about this book and what it's about and how you came to write it.
Well, in 2019, I wrote an op-ed for the Herald Leader about how our fantasies of what might happen in an apocalyptic scenario were just really radically different from anything I saw in the past as an archaeologist. And I'm not even sure who I imagined the audience would be. It just struck me as something I wanted to write about, and it caught on and resonated with folks and went viral, and I heard from people all around the globe about it, and eventually was contacted by a literary agent from New York who asked if I would consider expanding it into a book, which I did, and here we are.
Okay. Well, you're right that past apocalypses have been very different from the ones we imagine in novels and movies. So how is that?
Well, there are a lot of factors that, of course, make a good story. And part of the difference, I'm certain, is related to that. But in general, when we look at past apocalypses, we see that the collapse that we imagine is not the kind of collapse we see in these movies or these post-apocalyptic novels where most everyone is gone. It's a small group of people trying to survive up in the hills. That sort of scenario just hasn't happened. Even in situations where you had radical population decline, like Native American communities here after the arrival of Europeans, we still see that people maintain communities. And ultimately, what you go through to survive and the actions that you take are related to the community that perseveres.
What do you think are some of the most important lessons from these past events?
Well, I think if we look at our fantasies versus the actual evidence we have from archaeology, you see that there are really different sorts of activities that resolve the problem. In a modern apocalyptic narrative, you have a hero taking decisive heroic action to save the day. But as we saw during the pandemic, really the way to get through it was to do nothing, stay home, don't interact with people. You know, that makes an awful movie. And one of the reasons I think that we don't have a lot of fiction set in the 1918 flu epidemic is because the kinds of action that you have to take to get through it are really opposed to what we imagine in these narratives. In the narratives, we imagine there'll be a small group of people. They'll be focused on food and maybe defense and that sort of stuff. While I'm certain it happens on a certain scale for a certain amount of time, is really not what gets people through it. We saw even in Kentucky, when you had a decline of 75, 80, 90% of the population after the arrival of Europeans, that Native Americans continued to form and reform communities that show really the importance and the how critical it is that we band together.
So is that really that collective action is what you mean, as opposed to just the individual hero?
Well, yes, it must be collective. For instance, we live, all of us nearly on the planet, live in societies that are supported by agriculture. The last time that humanity was in a situation where there were significant amounts of people that were not farmers, they were still hunters and gatherers, there were less than 500 million people on the planet. That's about 1/15 of what we have now. So the idea that you could go back to some sort of situation in which you can do it by yourself is really just inconsistent with what we see in the past. We're going to need agricultural systems and distribution systems and all of the things that continue to provide us with the basics that we need to persevere.
Well, you know, we have so many problems today. We've got the rise of right-wing extremism. We've got increasing economic inequality and, of course, climate change. What are some of the most likely scenarios that you see for a future apocalypse, and how might we deal with them?
Well, I think those are the ones. Climate change is the obvious one. You can find evidence at the beginning of the 20th century of people realizing this was going to happen. By the 1970s, you know, it was well known in certain circles, but really it's probably been in the last 5 or 10 years where viscerally we've felt these changes. I mean, every day there's an unprecedented weather event. And so we can find infinite examples of that now. And so it's becoming clear that it's happening much faster than we imagine. That, I think, is going to be the thing behind all of these other issues, because that's going to put stress on other parts of our society. And ultimately, all of those stresses together will be the problem. You know, I think the other big thing is the rise of authoritarianism and the political issues. And these are not unrelated to climate change or these other stressors.
Well, how do you think we can deal with them effectively as opposed to kind of creating a worse catastrophe?
Well, one saying that has been around for a while is that there are no natural disasters. They're only natural phenomena. And the disaster part of it comes from our response to it. Now, that is, true, and it's a lesson for us. We can look at Hurricane Katrina, for instance, and the ways in which many other factors, you know, racial factors, socioeconomic status, and a whole other slew of things created this disaster that didn't have to happen the way it did. So I think to mitigate the disasters that we could have, part of what we're going to need are to be able to find good leaders, experts with good information, a populace that listens to experts. Hopefully, we'll be able to retreat a little bit from how politicized certain things have gotten. And then from there, really, it will be not that different from dealing with problems that we have. I think sort of the message of this book and of my earlier op-ed has been interpreted as hopeful. And it is on one hand, but it also implies that there's going to be a lot of the same kind of difficult work in governing and community action that we already are undertaking.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you write about is this kind of phenomena of what it's often called prepper culture. It's people who are always, you know, the survivalists and trying to prepare. Do you think this is, what's the attraction of this?
Well, I think part of the attraction is that preparing gives us the sense that we're doing something, right? Even if we're preparing in the wrong way, or even if we're preparing for the wrong disaster, we're not just sitting there. One of the reasons it was so hard to stay and do nothing at home is not just because we're contrary. It's because it's hard to do nothing.
Yeah.
And it really feels like you should be doing something. You know, and there's many examples in life of where we ought to really just rest and we don't. And so I think part of it is that the preparation makes you feel like you're doing something. The other part of it is, for at least some of these people, is that there are elements of modern society with which they're dissatisfied. And it allows this fantasy of a mythical past that we can somehow return to when all of this collapses and we don't have to deal with debt and banks and pressing one for English or whatever. We get to have this simple situation where we can concern ourselves with basic survival needs. We don't have to put up with the difficulties of living with all of the realities of a complex modern society. And so all of that, I think, goes into this.
What's the most important lesson you would like readers to take away from this book?
Well, the big lesson that we see from the past is that everything depends on community, and creating a vital and attractive community that people will want to participate in. And so things like fairness and equity become important, not simply for some moral reason or ethical reason, but because that's what allows a society to attract and keep people and to develop in the kind of ways that we're going to need it to do if we're going to reconstruct something that has really suffered from these phenomena.
Well, thanks very much, Dr. Chris Begley. And the book is The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. Thanks for being with us today.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
Tom Ebelin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. In his conversation with Tom Ebelin, Chris Begley said the message of his book, The Next Apocalypse, is hopeful, but calls on us to continue the hard work of making it so. An example of that hard work is happening in the Kentucky business community. Earlier this year, the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce laid out a challenge to the businesses that make up its membership: make deliberate, sustainable changes to overcome the racial inequality identified by a chamber task force on racial inequality. The task force issued its report in January, and we wanted to find out what's developed since then. So we invited Chamber President and CEO Ashley Watts to join us here on Eastern Standard. Welcome back, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me.
And what are some important findings of that task force?
So our task force met in the summer of 2020 when there was so much racial unrest, not only throughout the nation, but really, you know, in our backyard here in Louisville with the death of Breonna Taylor. And with such an important issue coming to the forefront, the business community and the key chamber leaders really said that we need to be part of the solution and not just get lip service, but really dig into the issue and see how we could use our sphere of influence to move the needle on the issue of racial inequality. And so we pulled together leaders from across the state, business, civic, education, who have been working in this field and kind of doing the work for many years to really help us think about how the chamber could make some sort of a difference in this whole world. We know many groups have been working on this and politicians, et cetera, but we wanted to use the platform we had to really try to make a difference. And so we came to the conclusion that, like the chamber typically does, we would start with the facts, start with the data, and then see where that leads us in terms of policy and then programmatic solutions. And so we spent many months digging into the data. And of course, you know, there is so much that can be uncovered when you talk about racial inequality across the Commonwealth. We really kind of narrowed our focus down to education, criminal justice reform, and economic empowerment. And so we started digging into the data. And frankly, I tell people this, it was pretty shocking to see the inequality across all categories in education and criminal justice reform and economic empowerment. And so we did not want to just publish a report with the data and say, yes, we know there's an issue, without proposing a solution. And so we did go through those three kind of buckets of education, criminal justice reform, and economic empowerment. And we do give policy and programmatic suggestions on how we can improve those areas to make things more equitable. Some things are things that could, you know, we could do in the short term. Some are a little bit more midterm, and then some are going to take quite a while. You know, we did not arrive to this issue overnight, and there's going to be a lot of work by a lot of different stakeholders to really make sure that we are on a path toward equity here in the Commonwealth. But from the business community standpoint, from the chamber's, you know, standpoint, and our leadership position, we really want to pull up a seat at the table and be part of that solution.
Well, Ashley, I know that you've made it known under your leadership there is going to be an ongoing initiative by the chamber to identify and to address inequities in the state's public and private institutions, policies, and programs. And I take it the chamber's member businesses are on board.
They absolutely are. And one of the great things that happened when we started doing the research and kind of figuring out where we could make our mark in this and where we could really make a difference was that we talked to key business leaders throughout Kentucky. And they said, you know, our company, our organization, wherever they represented, many years ago made a conscious decision to be more diverse. They said it was intentional. We did it because it was not only the right thing to do, but when you do that, when there's more diverse voices at the table, business is better. You know, the climate of your business is better. Personnel is better. And at the end of the day, even your bottom line is better. And so I think business leaders have a unique, you know, way to talk about this, that it's not just the right thing to do. We all know that it's the right thing to do, but everyone is risen up when we are intentional about diversity and inclusion. And so there was so much work that this report kind of uncovered and so much work to be done, not only legislatively and in policy, but also programmatic and really lifting people out of poverty, making sure the criminal justice system is fair, and really starting at the beginning to make sure that we're taking care of these children and our education system, that the chamber and our key leaders really thought this needs to be something that the chamber and the business community lives and breathes every day. And so what came out of this work was that it was so important to our membership that we now founded a center for DE&I, a center for diversity, equity, and inclusion, with some help from some of our business partners that helped fund it. And we announced the launch of that center and the launch of our new executive director, Joe Frazier from Louisville. He's been working at Bellarmine doing diversity and inclusion work for many years. And so now he'll join the chamber and really spearhead this work for us, so that everything the chamber does, whether it's policy, programs, events, anything that the chamber touches, we want to make sure that we're being intentional with diversity.
This task force report calls for putting numbers on what inequities cost Kentucky's citizens, businesses, and government in both revenue and missed opportunities. Is that analysis now underway?
So this is something that we've talked about, you know, for several years from the chamber's perspective. It's always, you know, we think data is always the great place to start because it's hard to argue with the numbers. It's hard to argue with the data when it's in front of you. And what we realize is that we put all of this data into one comprehensive, you know, 20-page report that's fairly easy to understand and digest. This needs to be done on a regular basis. We feel that lawmakers and policymakers and leaders throughout the Commonwealth need to see this data every year and to see if we're moving in the right direction. So one thing that we've talked about in the legislative process is looking at every, you know, all the bills that go through and make sure that it's not going to have an adverse effect on our minority population. That's something that many groups have worked on. But really what we want to see is that policymakers and lawmakers really every year take a look at these numbers. There are key indicators in here from education to criminal justice reform to economic empowerment and how much money someone makes that we could really follow and make sure that we're moving in the right path and that what we're doing is improving the situation across Kentucky.
This report notes as especially disturbing the fact that Black students' academic performance declines after they enter school, with large gaps between Black and white students in math and reading performance throughout elementary, middle, and high school. What do you suppose is behind this big gap in achievement?
That was honestly one of the most shocking things that we uncovered when doing this report. And it's data that's open to the public. We just, you know, we were the ones that kind of put it together in one document. But as a parent, I have a 6 and 9-year-old. The information that we found out about education was extremely startling. And what we realized through this data and our research is that kindergartners, whether you are white, Black, come into kindergarten about the same level. By the time they reach third grade, there is now a gap. There's a gap in achievement between Black students and white students, and something has gone awry there, and we have to do better. So what we know is they come into kindergarten on about even playing field. There's about the same amount of children that are prepared versus those that are not prepared in whatever race category you would put them in. But by the time they get to third grade, there is now a disparity, and that Black students are underachieving compared to white students. And so we really need to look at those early years of our elementary school system, preschool, et cetera, to make sure that we are making sure that all students have that same possibility for achievement. Another thing that was really shocking was that more Black students are disciplined at a higher rate than white students. And that's hard to kind of tackle. It's hard to kind of understand. But again, these are the facts. These are the numbers that we all really need to kind of uncover our eyes on to realize the situation that's happening across the Commonwealth, put our heads together, and make sure that we can work toward a difference.
There's another finding here that kind of stands out, and that is that Black students are significantly less prepared than our white students for life after high school, what is known as transition readiness. Why is that, and why is that important?
That's another thing that I think we really have to look at when we look at education, especially K through 12, is we know they all start off on somewhat of a level playing field in kindergarten, but that gap continues throughout not only elementary school with kind of looking at third grade reading levels, but also looking at high school graduation rates and college readiness. There are gaps. And so we, you know, as the business community, as employers, we want a diverse workforce. So our thinking is, what can we as a business community do help get these students ready for their next phase, whether that's college, whether that's a credential or a certificate, or whether that's employment. And so I think a lot of it is now up to not only the education system, but also the business community to really get involved in the education system, make sure that we're preparing our students for the jobs we have here in Kentucky. But yes, there is some startling numbers in there of the disparities that grow as student goes through school.
And there is the conclusion that, as the report puts it, Kentucky will never achieve its goals for educational excellence until it successfully tackles the disparities reflected in that achievement and opportunity gap data. And it calls for some action by the Kentucky Department of Education. What sorts of action?
I think there are many things that we could do. I mean, there are many issues that the Chamber has worked on for many years that you may not think that would be part of this, but it really is part of kind of the cohesive solution. For example, we have really wanted to make sure that every student fills out the FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid. Here in Kentucky, we have a lot of students that are eligible for free financial student aid at a federal level, and they just don't know they are because they don't fill out that form in high school. And so therefore, they think college is unattainable. It's just something that maybe isn't for them. But if we could get every high school student to fill out this form, they may be able to see the possibility of what is after high school. They maybe never thought they could afford college, but when they get back this form, they may realize they could have some help in terms of scholarships and financial aid. And so there are some simple things like that that we could really do. But another thing that the General Assembly has done in the last year that we do think is a great step towards improvement is really transparency. And there is now a task force to make sure that these issues are talked about, they are discussed and debated, and that policy solutions are discussed. And this task force, we're really excited. Hopefully they will be looking at the data every year. They're going to be looking at these education numbers and trying to put a policy spin on that so that those numbers, we can get them more equitable.
Well, Ashley, some might see this through a cynical lens and say, oh, well, it's just the times. This is just business seeking its path of least resistance. And the reality of it is that racial inequities will remain just under the surface. How would you respond to that point of view?
That is something, of course, last summer that we thought about when we pulled together this task force. And we knew that many groups were doing something like this, and it would have been very easy for the chamber and for the business community to issue a report, issue a statement, put it on a shelf, feel good that we did something in that moment in time. And that's not what we did. We have committed to this work now. We have gotten commitments from our businesses to help fund this work. We now have a center for DE&I so that we are going to be a resource for all businesses and all employers across the state. And we now have one person, really hopefully more when we continue to grow, that is going to be living and breathing this work. And what we know, and we have businesses that will attest to this all over the Commonwealth, that when you are intentional about diversity, whether that's in education, whether that's in business, it is a good thing. It's a good thing for everyone. The more diverse people at the table, the better the product is going to be. And so from a business perspective, it's not only the right thing to do. We know that it's the right thing to do, but it's the best thing for everyone to do. We know that really by being intentional, everyone rises. There's better products, there's better work environments, there's better personnel, and ultimately there's better bottom lines, which is something we all want.
The report is titled Achieving Equity to Build a Stronger Kentucky. I take it it's online, can be found there and downloaded from there?
It is, kychamber.com.
That's Ashley Watts, President and CEO of the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me.
Working to bring about positive change in the way we coexist with the rest of the natural world is the Kentucky Resources Council, and the council has new leadership. After 37 years as the council's director, Tom Fitzgerald has moved into a senior staff role and is now succeeded by Ashley Wilms, a Center College grad who went on to obtain a specialty certificate in environmental and natural resources law at the University of Oregon. She has represented organizations across the country on environmental matters and is chair of the environmental law section of the Kentucky Bar Association. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's a Wendell Berry quote that seems really fitting as a way to begin this conversation, Ashley. He says, "Do unto those downstream as you would have those upstream do unto you." I even have it on a T-shirt. Does that pretty much sum up what the Kentucky Resources Council is all about?
It does. And that's one of my favorite Wendell Berry quotes as well. Kentucky Resources Council is the only statewide environmental nonprofit that provides free legal services to citizens and community groups on energy and environmental matters. And, we work to make sure that people have a voice in the decision-making process, and basically that there's a place to turn if your life or community is impacted by an environmental issue, whether that's a concern about air pollution from a nearby facility or, contamination from a gas pipeline or coal ash impoundment.
Well, you are among those organizations working to move Kentucky up on the good list and down on the bad list. What are the big issues on your desk right now?
One of the issues we're working on is trying to protect Bernheim Forest in their fight against a 12-mile gas pipeline that LG&E is trying to build through a part of Bernheim Forest. This is a tract known as the Cedar Grove Wildlife Corridor, and it is subject to a conservation easement that's held by the state, which is meant to protect the area from, removing, trees and impacting streams in a way that this pipeline is going to do. So the route of the LG&E pipeline would cut directly through this area that's home to, the endangered Indiana bat, and Kentucky gladecrest and other imperiled species. So we are working to protect this area from this pipeline proposed by LG&E.
Well, I mentioned water, and I know clean water supply ties directly into coal mine reclamation, and the Reclaim Act, updating funding for reclamation projects, was just passed by Congress and signed into law by President Biden. Is that something that's on your radar? And if so, now that that has been passed and signed, what happens next with it?
Well, we were really excited to see that the Reclaim Act makes a large investment in coal communities. So included in this bill is $11.3 billion to clean up abandoned mine lands. And that's going to be distributed over about 15 states based on historic coal production. But Kentucky is one of those that's going to receive a lot of money from that, which is important because we need approximately $900 million for abandoned mine cleanup in the state. And to put things in perspective, last year we only got about $9 million to address those sites. And Kentucky ranks third among all states with these abandoned mine reclamation needs. So we're really excited that the Reclaim Act addressed that, although even more is needed. Another part that we were really happy to see in that bill is that it's going to provide funding to help properly close abandoned oil and gas wells, which can be a major problem both for climate and for just public health problems associated with air pollution if those are not closed properly. So Kentucky's legislature has set up a fund to help close these wells. And so this funding is really needed. And we were glad to see that that was part of the Reclaim Act. So we are following that closely.
In the meantime, where is the Kentucky Resources Council on the matter of solar energy?
Well, we know there's a lot of opposition to some of these projects in places like Clark County. But I think that part of the problem here is that communities and developers have not done a good enough job engaging the public, engaging the community early, and engaging them often to, address the concerns that people have about these projects. And that really the opposition is more about perceived risk, whether that's devaluing you know, nearby land, which the data actually shows is not the case, or what's going to happen during construction. But we know that solar is an important component to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and we think that a lot of these projects can be done really well, but need more public participation. Again, you know, we would like to see communities and developers do a better job of engaging the public early and often on these projects. But one of the things we have done to address this issue is a model solar ordinance. So if you go on our website under, you know, under model ordinances, we have the Kentucky Model Solar Zoning Ordinance. And we wrote this to assist localities in adopting provisions to help regulate and address the siting of these solar energy facilities in their communities. And we based this on a review of best practices from across the United States, but have tailored it to meet the needs of Kentucky. So we really want to help assist localities in figuring out the appropriate siting of these solar facilities, and then also being mindful of protecting the, you know, the rights of landowners to use and enjoy their land next door.
So it sounds to me as though what is needed, or one of the major components of need in this whole conversation, is that communication you're talking about. Perhaps forums or town hall meetings to discuss them. Any plans by the Kentucky Resources Council to facilitate some form of communication about solar energy?
I can see us doing that in the coming year. We don't have plans at this time. Mm-hmm. Kentucky Conservation Committee, I know, is working with community groups as well in trying to help alleviate some of the community concerns about these projects and make sure the right information is getting out there. And we plan to help do the same. Right now, like I said, our focus has been on this model solar zoning ordinance, and we are working directly with a lot of counties on helping to figure out how this works with their existing zoning ordinances, you know, and again, how to engage their communities.
Am I correct that the Kentucky Resources Council offers pro bono assistance on environmental issues?
Yeah. So we are the only statewide environmental nonprofit that provides free legal services to citizens and communities on energy and environmental matters. In the past year, we've provided more than $1 million in pro bono legal services. And, you know, that's really important to us. We believe that, you know, people need a place to turn when their life or community is impacted by an environmental issue, whether that's a concern about air pollution from a nearby facility or contamination from a gas pipeline. One of our goals is to remove economic barriers to environmental justice. And we know that often the people that are most impacted by environmental abuse, I mean, those people that live downhill, downwind, downstream, you know, can't afford to engage legal representation. And so we want to remove those barriers and make sure that, you know, if there's a bad project in your community or there's a facility that isn't complying with the terms of its permit and you're concerned about pollution in your area, that you've got a place to turn.
Is it a matter of no issue too large or small, or do you have to be, due to funding, do you have to be selective in what you take on?
Well, we do want to have the broadest reach and the biggest impact that we can have. But we have an intake form on our website. And so, you know, if you have an issue that you want on our radar or you want us to take a look at, we welcome the public to go on to our website and fill out an intake form, and, you know, we'll follow up. Our goal, again, is to remove these economic barriers to environmental justice and make sure that those people or those communities that really need a voice, that we can offer those services.
So, Ashley, you are another of us returnees, that is, Kentuckians who've gone to other places to learn, gain experiences, make observations, and have brought that knowledge and experience back to apply it in the Commonwealth. What motivates you?
Well, I'm really grateful to have had those experiences. My family and career have taken us to Oregon and Chicago and Pennsylvania. We spent almost a decade in Boulder, Colorado, where I was in-house counsel for an environmental advocacy organization called Wild Earth Guardians. And, you know, really in Oregon and Colorado, I got to learn from some of the best environmental attorneys in the country. And so I'm grateful to have had those opportunities and to be able to bring those experiences back here to Kentucky. You know, at some point, the scales tipped and we really felt drawn back to Kentucky. Our kids were entering grade school, you know, but our family's here and our roots are here. And, you know, we knew we wanted to be actively engaged in our community, like both Lexington and statewide, you know, to be a part of enacting change and focusing on environmental justice and basically helping to protect the places that we grew up exploring and loving.
All right, that's Ashley Wilms, Director of the Kentucky Resources Council. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, a Kentucky play about a love story that spans not only social barriers, but time as well. And a new book from Woodsong's creator and host, Michael Jonathan. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council, coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts. Through December 23rd, Danville's Arts Center of the Bluegrass will hold its Holiday Market, a curated shopping experience showcasing handcrafted gifts by dozens of local and regional artists. Hours are Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, visit artscenterky.org. And the Grand Theater in Frankfurt will present a broadcast of the Met Opera's Cinderella, 1 p.m. January 1st. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit thegrandky.com. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Bill McCann is here with the first in his new Eastern Standard series on all things theater in Kentucky.
Recently, the Kentucky Theater Association celebrated the conclusion of this year's Roots of the Bluegrass New Play Contest by announcing the winners at an in-person and virtual awards ceremony. Among the winners was Richmond playwright Rusty Reckenbach, who writes under the pen name Richard Cavendish. A retired minister, Rusty is active as a performer, director, and producer with theaters in both Madison and Clark counties and is registered with the Dramatists Guild of America under the pen name Richard Cavendish. As Richard Cavendish, Rusty Reckenbach has been a winner or finalist in the Roots of the Bluegrass contest for a record 4 consecutive years. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
What was the name of your play and what was it about?
The play that I submitted this year, which was one of the finalists, is Day of Releasement. And it is a play about Shaker Village here in Kentucky and about Patsy Williamson, who was a slave brought to the village with a family, and she became a free person and an equal there because of the Shaker beliefs. And she stayed there. In fact, the family left and Shaker Village bought her freedom from the family so that she could stay. And she became a very well-known hymn writer. And so I've written the play around 1812 that deals with her story, and then more in the future of Randy Fogle, who was a reenactor and musician and composer and historian with the Shakers. And his part is set in 1999. And these two people who are so different from each other, a man and a woman, black and white, one living in the 19th century and the other one in the 20th century, fall in love. They are connected through the music that they are gifted with. The Shakers were very spiritual people with visions and so forth. And so when I wrote this play, I knew that it had to be about very mystical. And that's the part of it, is that they are transcended through their music. And these two come to know each other, to know they're in different time periods and different backgrounds.
Sounds interesting. So when and why did you begin writing plays?
You know, I've been writing plays all my life, many of them produced in Richmond. And I felt a calling, you know. My experience with Pamela Travers, the writer, she had said to me that these plays, our stories, are hovering over us in the universe. and that they're waiting for someone to catch on to them as a scribe, this kind of thing, and to write their stories. And I really believe that that's the way it's been for me. These stories have come to me and said, you know, this needs to be written. Will you be the one to write it?
Talk to us about some of your other plays. You traditionally write Kentucky historical plays. So tell us about some of the others.
The Botanic Garden is our beloved Transylvania University and its heyday with the president, Horace Holly, who brings this very eccentric botanist, Raffinesque, who has a great dream of a botanic garden. And of course, Kentucky is all a garden in itself, a wilderness, and yet he wants to have a museum and garden and so forth. And it's all about dreams and how we follow them and how we deny them and how they can make us or destroy us. Sabbath of the Soul is about Emily Tubman, who was a benefactress in the 1800s. When my home church in Frankfort burned in 1870, she rebuilt the entire church. Her husband had died and left her a multimillionaireess, and she spent her life helping other people. It's basically about that.
Let's talk about your book a little bit. I notice it's quite unique in that you've got five plays in there, but you also have essays, historical essays, complete with footnotes, about the people and events of your plays. How did you come to do that?
I wanted the history to be correct. There wasn't a way to footnote the script, so I did postscripts to give a history of the background of the play and the historical events of the play, so that the plays were legitimate and not just coming from nowhere and fictionalized. The play about Elmwood in Richmond, Emma Watts, the history of her life, everything in it is correct, as explained in the postscript, but the idea of the play is historical fiction with this architect coming to tear the house down. That's always been the great fear in Richmond of this house being torn down. Emma Watts loved this house. She was born the year the house was built, and she lived her whole life there. And when she died, she left her will so that the university would never get the house. And she left money for the house to be kept up. So this house has always been kept up with nobody living in it. The idea of the play was that the university, which has acquired the house now, but before that happened, I had written this play. And so an architect in the historical fiction part of the play has been called to take the house down and to build a student center. And he meets her spirit, if you will, and they actually fall in love. Even though I wrote it, it's such a good play. It really is. And it has a lot of different dimensions to it. It's also a play about a man coming to terms with himself and his feminine side, if you will, and becoming holistic. And I won't spoil the play, but it's called Emma of Elmwood. The other two plays in that collection is The Two Villages, about Paul Sawyer and Mamie Bull, his fiancée, who had a relationship their entire life and had been engaged for a long time but never set a date. And she finds out that he has seen a young girl and comes to his houseboat to confront him. And they break up, and their lifelong friendship is destroyed. It's a very dramatic event that happened in these two first person's life. Paul Sawyer was a painter in the early 1900s and painted so much of Frankfort. And he had a houseboat that started at Frankfort and went to High Bridge, where she came to confront him. And the other play is about the Battle of Richmond here in Madison County, The Dust of Summer, about the Armstrong family and the Confederate army that comes in surprise, and the Union troops are not ready and are destroyed tragically. In 1862.
If listeners would like to contact you about performing some of your plays, how would they do that?
I have a website, richardcavendish.com, and then Facebook, Richard Cavendish.
And if they would like to buy the book, how would they do that?
Well, they can order it through Author House. It's available on all kinds of bookstores and sites and so forth, but the best one is Author House, and I mean, or they can contact me and I can sell them a copy. I don't ever expect to get the money back that I put into it. It's a service that I've done because I believe in these stories and I want to share them with people. I want people to enjoy the things that I enjoy. You know, when you love something, you want to share it with other people. And the life of Raffinesque and Horace Holly and Mary Holly and Emily Tubman and Emma Watts and the Armstrongs and Paul Sawyer and Mamie Bull and Shaker Village, you know, are all very dear to my heart.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Mary, thanks for asking me.
Oh, you're welcome. My guest today has been Richmond playwright Rusty Reckenbach, who writes under the name Richard Cavendish and was one of the finalists for the fourth year in a row of the Roots of the Bluegrass New Play Contest, sponsored by the Kentucky Theater Association. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill.
WoodSongs creator and host Michael Jonathan is out with a new book, A Folk Singer's Fireplace Compendium and Van Gogh Reader, and he's here to tell us what's inside this book. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what's this book about?
You know, it's about every artist, creator, dreamer, painter, songwriter that is struggling in a post-pandemic digital tsunami world trying to find an audience.
And so why do you call it a Van Gogh reader?
Well, I use Van Gogh as a touchstone for a lot of the lessons in the book. But there's a lot of stories in there. You know, one of my favorites is the famous Starry Night painting that everybody knows and loves. And it's on everything from coffee cups to billboards to everything. But Vincent tried to give that painting away three times, give it away as a gift, and was refused each time. You know, Rembrandt, the great Rembrandt that everybody reveres and so honored and considered a master, he died an unknown pauper. He was broke. He was buried in an unmarked grave. And these are the lessons that a lot of artists that are struggling need to know, that just because you're struggling does not mean you don't have value, that you've got to stick with it. And here's examples of a myriad of artists that are going through what you're going through right now.
You have an account in the book about something that you were told in person by the great folk artist Pete Seeger. Tell us about that experience.
Yes, I was at his home in Beacon, New York. He was my neighbor in Beacon. And I was there for dinner, and there was a couple of songwriters there, as was common. And one of them was doing his very, very best impersonation of Bob Dylan. And at the end of the night, I could tell Pete was not very pleased with that because the kid wasn't finding his own voice. He was making believe he was Bob Dylan. And Pete, as he was walking me out, asked what I thought about Bob Dylan's visit that night. And I said something nice. And he told me that it's good to be inspired, but never imitate, never copy. And I found that to be true with a lot of folks that are inspired by people like Pete Seeger or Bob Dylan or others. They try to clone that artist in their own work, and you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to find your own voice.
It's so interesting. There are great artists out there who do that well. People like Ray Charles did it. He was one of the great cover artists of all time, I think. And then we recently had this concert, Music for Mission, which was a tribute to Stevie Wonder. And as you're saying, it was the music of Stevie Wonder, but everybody made it their own, as they put it. And I guess that's what Pete Seeger was counseling.
Very much. You know, you find your own voice. You don't try to inhabit somebody else's. You know, Frank Sinatra was one of the greatest cover artists ever. He didn't write his own songs.
Right.
You know, Elvis Presley, the same thing. He was a cover artist. He didn't write his own music. You know, he used other people's, but they had absolute distinct voices. And compliments where compliments are due. Tom Martin is an excellent artist. You are a fantastic piano player and Hammond B3, but you're not out trying to be Chris Lavelle. You're Tom Martin. You know, you bring your own touch and color and personality to a song. And that's what an artist is supposed to do.
Well, thank you for that, Michael. I'm terribly flattered.
That's true.
I'm no Chuckley Bell, that's for sure. Well, listen, there's a CD inside the back cover of the book. What's on it?
Well, the first thing that I wrote was a compliment to, I always loved the Don McLean song, Starry, Starry Night. One of my favorite songs to perform.
Which brings us around to Van Gogh again, of course.
It brings you right down to Van Gogh, and that got me thinking. I wrote a bookend to Vincent, Starry, Starry Night, of my own called The Painter. And then that gave me the idea of the album, and so I included songs that represented the canvas and color of love and life. I even included Harry Chapin's Cats in the Cradle, because what greater painting can we ever do as human beings in our own home and our own family? But most of the songs on the album are original. And so I put that with the book, as the Wood Songs book series does. There's always a full album with the book. And in this case, the Painter complements what Wood Songs 5 is about, and it inspired the writing of the screenplay about Vincent Van Gogh that I'm working on now.
Well, I can envision pulling up the book and putting the CD on, and I know that you're a fan of The Front Porch, so that seems like a great combination.
Well, it's a gentle kick in the groin to artists who tend to complain because things are not working out too well. And what I wanted in Wood Songs 5 was an example of artists that never quit, that never gave up, that followed their dream, that searched out for their voice. And even if when their life ended, they didn't see their success, look at the brilliant work that they left behind that everybody loves so much today. And that's the statement of our life. And that's what I wanted the book to be about.
All right. Where can we find the book?
You know, you can go to michaeljonathan.com. If you become a Wood Songs partner, you get a free copy. And then in January, it'll be in bookstores like Amazon and Walmart and Barnes & Noble and everything else. You can go to michaeljonathan.com and even get the ebook now. It's available as an ebook.
All right. Michael Jonathan, creator and host of the Wood Songs Old Time Radio Hour, which airs Saturdays at 8 p.m. here on WEKU. And you can take in a live taping of the show on Monday evenings at the Lyric Theater in Lexington. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Tom, thank you so much.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer. Wendy Barnett, producer. Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find us online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.